It was dark in the climate-controlled tent, dark except for the glow from the electronic panel with controls for temperature, ventilation, and humidity, and a small lantern in the center of a camp table. Natalia sat in a chair, resting her booted feet on the table. Annie sat to her right at the small table, crocheting.
Sometimes it's very distressing to be a woman, Annie.
And we should be with them. If Mama were here, she'd want to be with them too.
This is very uncomfortable for me.
Me too. But more so for you, I guess.
John was worried that if something went wrong...
Daddy loves you. He doesn't want Karamazov getting his hands on you again.
This is important. More important than one life. My life.
What are you going to do?
I don't know, Annie.
Natalia stood up and lifted the flaps on the holsters at her hips, but it was Maria Leuten.
Dr. Leuten, come and join us.
Thank you, Major Tiamarovna, I will.
My name is Natalia.
Call me Maria, please.
Well, Maria, please. It's nice to see you.
Maria Leuten sat as Natalia dropped back into the chair across the table.
I was worried about Michael, and your husband, Mrs. Rubinstein, and the doctor, and Otto Hammerschmidt.
Annie! Everybody calls me Annie. Even my mother started to, finally. Used to always call me Anne.
Anne is a pretty name. It was my mother's name.
Natalia never knew her mother, except through those last reminiscences of her uncle. And her uncle was not really her uncle. She envied people who knew their mothers, could conjure the memory of their mothers.
We were just saying that we didn't like being left behind.
I wouldn't know what to do. I mean, well, but I've never been in combat.
It's not a heck of a lot of fun, Maria, let me tell you.
It's different for the two of you. I mean...
A Russian major?
Yes. Yes, Natalia, but...
Annie set down her crocheting.
My husband, my father, and my brother are out there, along with a German army officer who seems like an all right guy. I'd like to be out there, too, to keep them out of trouble.
Natalia opened her mouth to speak, but didn't. The most dangerous part was coming down the rock wall silently. John Rourke and Otto Hammerschmidt rappelled in tandem. Rourke's ears pricked for the slightest sounds, and there were many. Small rocks dislodged in the otherwise almost unnatural stillness of the night. They kept going. Rourke eased the rope through his gloved hands, working the strand through the straight eight at the level of his abdomen. Within the special German rappelling gloves were the gloves that accompanied the jumpsuit. The suit gloves were designed to seal with the wrists of the jumpsuit, specifically designed to guard against barbed wire and other potential punctures. He could see the ground beneath them clearly, see the roving team of guards, nearly at their maximum distance from the point at which Rourke chose for the team to rappel down. In a moment, the guards would be turning around, would start back, would be alerted. Rourke pushed off again and jumped, breaking his fall against the harness, dropping into a crouch beside the rock wall. Hammerschmidt hit the ground a second later. Rourke tugged at his rope three times, then reached to one of the leg pouches, opening the silent fastener. Michael and Paul would be coming down quickly and would be spotted by the guards. Rourke palmed a blackened, forged, stainless steel four-point ninja star, another peculiar item utilized by the German commandos. He glanced toward Hammerschmidt. He was ready. They were blackness in blackness. The sky mercifully overcast, their clothes designed to be shadows in the night. Rourke tugged away the repelling glove. The sensitivity of the suit's gloves were so excellent he could have operated while wearing them. He adjusted the microphone in his gas mask.
I've got the one on the right. At the count of three. One, two, three.
Rourke hurled the star, his target less than 30 feet away. The star buried itself in the throat of the man. Rourke dove forward, throwing another star. Rourke's knife was in his fist by the time he reached the body, but he had no need to use it. The man beneath him was dead. Rourke glanced at Hammerschmidt. Hammerschmidt nodded back.
Dead. Good. Drag him this way.
Rourke grabbed the dead man by the ankles, hauling him deeper into the shadow by the immediate base of the wall. He withdrew the shuriken then, wiping it clean of blood on the dead man's uniform. He then returned the star to the pouch on the leg of his jumpsuit. He took up the soldier's rifle, removed the magazine, worked the action, and popped the chambered round. Quickly, Rourke searched the body. He found a utility folding knife, what apparently was underground city currency, and a handkerchief, but no other weapons. He field-stripped the rifle. Clutching the rifle in his left hand, he ran toward the spot where Michael and Paul were finishing their descent. Michael was shucking the rope, Paul doing the same, each of them tugging at the ropes. The ropes quickly disappeared, pulled up the rockside by Hammerschmidt's men under the command of Sergeant Decker. The men removed their weapons from their secure bindings, then turned to face their first destination. The Soviet position nearest the greenhouses was some 200 yards away.
No guns.
With his unburdened left hand, he signaled, "Move out." Rourke broke into a long-strided, loping run. He remembered a line from the many adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
"Gentlemen, the game is afoot."
They agreed it would be knives, hands, and garrotes, but guns would not be used unless it meant the sacrifice of the entire team. Rourke carried the black cat's paw-handled Gerber MK2 in his right fist. John Rourke ran at the lead. To his right, Paul Rubinstein. Behind them, Michael and Otto Hammerschmidt. The lens material of the gas masks stayed surprisingly clear during exertion, and the mask itself was comfortable to wear. They hugged the rock wall until its end, having crossed half of the length of the rear of Karamazov's line. At the edge of the rock wall, they stopped.
Son of a bitch is pretty confident so far. Hope he stays confident, doesn't expect anything from his rear. Follow my lead. Let's go.
John Rourke would have been a grandfather in a matter of months, if not for Vladimir Karamazov killing his daughter-in-law, Madison. As he ran, he tried recalling if he had ever really hated before. One of the Soviet jeep vehicles was ahead of them. Its occupants were oblivious to the commando team's presence.
Otto, Michael, go get him.
Rourke dodged left, Paul running even beside him now. At the far right corner of his restricted vision, he watched Michael move as if in slow motion. His right gloved fist went to his chest, withdrawing the massive life support system 2, as Michael called it. Michael moved right, Hammerschmidt left, toward the targets of the two men who stood beside the Soviet vehicle. Michael and Hammerschmidt moved as though in some ballet. They worked remarkably well together. There was a sixth sense that men who fought together and routinely saved each other's lives developed. John and Paul had this. It seemed Michael and Otto Hammerschmidt had it as well. To the left, Hammerschmidt reached his target as he was wheeling toward him, raising his Soviet Animov 60 assault rifle. Hammerschmidt knocked the weapon aside as he plunged the blade into the throat with a rapier thrust. Michael slid up behind his man, driving his 9-inch blade through the man's spine at the base of his skull. Rourke saw the dull flash of a blade. He couldn't tell the type at the distance. He made to start toward them, but he felt Paul's hand restraining him at his left forearm. Rourke started running again. He glanced back once. Michael and Otto Hammerschmidt were behind them, the Soviet assault rifles in their hands. To the right, from the front of Karamazov's lines, there was gunfire, and from the far right, by the airfield, hundreds of yards away, there was the boom of artillery. The night sky shone nearly as bright as day for an instant. Artillery answered almost immediately from near the entrance to the underground city. More flashes of light.
The energy weapons! Artillery!
Damn it! Karamazov's attacking. We might be too late.
Rourke waved the others forward, breaking into a dead run. Artillery shells exploded around them on all sides as the energy weapons flashed like lightning. Rourke dodged left, angling toward the furthest extension of Karamazov's lines that approached the greenhouses. There was a flash of brilliant light as another of the energy weapons fired, a huge machine the size of field artillery. But in the flash of light, John Rourke could see the shadow of a figure, then another, and perhaps more, running toward the greenhouses. Soviet troops ran about everywhere, mortar teams setting up, riflemen withdrawing from positions under heavy artillery and mortar fire from the tunnel entrance to the underground city. They were nearing the furthest extension of the battle line now, the greenhouses more clearly visible. Rourke held the M16 in his right fist, his arm extended. A phalanx of Soviet soldiers suddenly threw themselves up like a wall across Rourke's path. Rourke's team opened fire. Paul used his submachine gun alongside Rourke. Silence didn't matter now as they closed with a line of Soviet troopers. The wall of Soviets before them taken down, they kept on running. Rourke searched but couldn't see Michael or Hammerschmidt.
Michael! Otto! Where are you?
We're on the way.
Two Soviet troopers with Animov rifles were running to cut him off. far left edge of his peripheral vision, Rourke could see Paul.
Paul! The furthest greenhouse out! Go for it!
Right!
Rourke stopped, wheeled 90 degrees with his M16, and aimed at more Soviet troops. Bodies jackknifed into the darkness. The M16 empty, Rourke let it drop to his side on its sling. He filled his hands with his scoremasters. Single shots, he couldn't afford the luxury of double taps. He was almost at the end of the line now. Rourke saw tubes belching gray smoke against the darkness, machine gun nests with maddened gunners.
Barbed wire! Watch it, John, I'm over.
Thanks, Michael! Ammo, you catch that?
Got it!
Ahead of him, Rourke could see the concertina wire. A Soviet trooper rose up in front of him, but Rourke swung each pistol toward the trooper's chest. Rourke caught the body as it sagged away. He then threw the body over the concertina wire. Rourke leaped up, vaulting over the wire across the dead man's back. Clear of the wire, he rammed both pistols into their holsters. He found his M16 with his right fist as he grabbed for another magazine. The furthest greenhouse was perhaps 300 yards. He could see Paul ahead of him. A lightning bolt pulsed from an energy weapon impacted the ground near Rourke's feet. He tucked his body into a roll as he fell, coming up out of it, to his knees, dirt and debris falling about him like rain. He lurched to his feet, his mind and body reeling with the impact, and ran on. 200 yards to go, with Paul well ahead of him, he was almost to the greenhouse's near wall. In the flash of light from a conventional artillery burst, he saw Paul silhouetted against the wall for an instant. Rourke looked back. Michael was clearing the fence in a running jump, using the lifeless Soviet body as his platform. Otto Hammerschmidt, right behind him, carried a Soviet assault rifle in each of his hands. 100 yards from the greenhouse, they ran under the withering weapons barrage. But here, in the no-man's land between the battle lines, the chance of impact from artillery or mortar fire was more remote. Rourke saw Paul vanish into the greenhouse. Rourke threw himself into the run, letting the M16 drop to his side. He changed the magazines for the scoremaster from the musette bag that hung at either side of his gear. He threw himself to the ground beside the greenhouse. He tried to segregate sounds from within the greenhouse from those of the battle raging around him. He thought he heard the working of a pistol slide. He got to his feet.
We are entering the near greenhouse here, Rourke. We see them. Four persons. One may be a woman. They have a canister.
Rourke ran along the length of the greenhouse. It was a glass and metal reinforced door. Rourke's left foot snapped forward as he wheeled half right, landing a double taekwondo kick to the glass. Rourke stabbed both pistols into his belt, then caught up the M16. With the butt of the rifle, he knocked out the remainder of the glass, then walked through.
Look out, John!
Rourke looked to his right as he hit the floor of the greenhouse and rolled. Rourke squinted involuntarily against the dust spray despite the protection of the gas mask. He came out of the roll, aiming the M16 toward the flash from the darkness. He got to his feet, watching the darkness.
I'm to your left, John. Three of them left in here, I think.
Rourke edged right, ducking behind a table holding broad-leafed plants. Water dribbled down along the length of the table. Some of the plants overturned. He saw movement at the far end of the greenhouse.
Paul, move up along the left. I'll move up along the right before you shoot.
I know. You do the same.
In a crouch, he started forward, between the tables of plants and the greenhouse wall, picking his footing carefully. Hoses, pipes, shattered pots from plants, and fallen trays of seedlings were everywhere. When the first of them entered the greenhouses, Natalia would have been put on alert, a helicopter waiting for her. But it would do no good for her to appeal to the Soviet combatants if Rourke or Paul or Michael or Hammerschmidt didn't get the information on the gas that would give her the facts she needed to convince the fighters that Karamazov was only using them.
Natalia, you hear me?
I hear you, John. You, Paul, Michael, and the captain.
We're fine. As soon as we get to the gas, be ready.
Be careful.
I will. You be ready.
Once again, Rourke crept along, the M16 held tight against his chest. Not the ideal weapon for the confined space, but his only weapon capable of a sufficient volume of fire.
John, about 30 yards up, there's some sort of valve control. One of them is there, on your side.
Rourke squinted into the darkness. He could barely see the figure. He slowly, silently readied the M16. Rourke reached to his left boot top and withdrew the Russell Black Chrome Sting 1A. He checked the ground, looking for shards of pottery or other objects that might crush under body weight and make a betraying noise. He could see the figure clearly now, on guard, it seemed, holding what appeared to be a silenced SMG. The muzzle swept right to left. As long as the muzzle moved, the subgunner held no definite target, Rourke realized. Once it stopped moving, either he or Paul would be in trouble. Rourke kept moving.
Dad, we got them. All of them. Hammersmith put a knife to one man's throat. The guy told us about the gas. It's something totally new, but you were right. Karamazov stashed it 5 centuries ago, just after the night of the war. It has a biological effect once it's inhaled. It's not skin-absorptive, but it's colorless, odorless, and tasteless, so no one will know it's being used until it's too late. It affects male hormones, triggers unbridled aggression. Karamazov could have turned every man in the underground city into a homicidal maniac.
Rourke didn't answer his son. To use his voice would betray his position. He had narrowed the distance to the subgunner to 10 yards. With his left hand, his right clutching the Sting 1A, he picked up a pottery fragment and hurled it well ahead of Paul's estimated position on his left. The subgunner wheeled to his right. Rourke got to his feet in a dead run, hurtling his body against the subgunner. It was a woman. As the woman fell through the glass wall, Rourke's right hand thrust forward, the knife cutting into her throat. Rourke pushed himself up and back. He drew back against the plant tables, still without his rifle. He wiped the blood from his blade by stabbing it into the dirt of an overturned rubber plant.
John, are you all right?
Yeah, fine. You heard Michael?
I'm going to be airborne in less than a minute.
Be persuasive. If you can't get them to lay down their arms, at least get them to withdraw from the field. We got 2 more here to get.
John, I found them. Hurry!
Rourke was to his feet, resheathing the knife. He grabbed the Detonic Scoremaster 45s.
Michael! You and Hammerschmidt, get out with the gas canister! Get it airborne to Argentina fast! That tank they dug up out of the desert would have held thousands of gallons of the stuff in liquid form, probably concentrated. That's the primary objective. Get it out!
Right. On the way. Good luck.
Rourke reached the end of the long row of tables. The gunfire was distinct, just ahead and to the left. Rourke jumped onto the table to see what was happening. A blower started. Rourke could see Paul locked in hand-to-hand combat with a man at least a head taller. Another man worked the valves on a silver-colored metallic cylinder attached to a pipe stem. Rourke brought both pistols up to eye level. The body of the person beside the canister rocked with the hits, spinning and falling. Rourke took a running leap, bypassing Paul and the man Paul fought. He lunged for the canister valves.
Jesus!
The valves were wide open. He started turning them closed, but the valves were threaded so the handle would slip off the stem after opening. The valves could not be closed.
Michael! Otto! Don't work the canister valves! They're one-way valves! The canister has to be blended to another container under controlled conditions!
Understood.
Rourke wheeled as Paul's right fist crossed the jaw of his opponent. The man spun toward Rourke.
The blower!
Rourke ran to the controls. The dials were twisted off. He needed pliers, but had none. He looked at the base of the blower unit and saw the power cable connecting it to the electrical output.
Shit! Paul! Out of here, quick!
Rourke aimed a Scoremaster toward the cable. The 185-grain JHP severed the cable. Sparks flew, then suddenly flames erupted from the machine. Rourke jumped back. He upped the Scoremaster's safety and ran, back the way he had come.
Paul! We gotta get into the underground city! See what can be done! See the effects of the gas! It's our only defense against it now!
Rourke came up on the M16 he had left behind and snatched it. Paul was waiting for him beside the blown-out portion of a wall, changing sticks in the MP40 subgun as Rourke reached the opening. They ran on. Natalia hovered in the night sky aboard a lightless, soundless helicopter.
Comrades! This is Major Natalia Anastasia Tiamarovna of the Committee for State Security. You have been betrayed by my husband, Vladimir Karamazov. He is not a hero. He is a traitor to you, to Russia, to Russia's history, to all the people of the world. He is evil. You fight now, brother against brother, father against son, all in service to Karamazov's lust for power. As you fight now, he sends commando teams to the underground city. The commando teams carry a deadly gas unlike any used before, even in the most vicious of fighting. It affects only men. It will reduce every man inside the underground city to a blood-crazed madman. A madman who will turn on his comrades, male and female. The infected will be no more than beasts, killing any living thing they find. Fall back, comrades. Do not fight. Do not die so Vladimir Karamazov can make himself your dictator. Fall back, comrades. In the name of the Soviet people, fall back.
John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein ran toward the tunnel entrance of the underground city. Rourke wheeled to check the rear. Soviet troops from Karamazov's command were running forward, their rifles not in assault positions, some of them without rifles at all.
Anya! Anya!
They ran without helmets, one with his arms outspread for his wife in the underground city.
Anya!
Two men move among you. They are dressed all in black. These men are not your enemies. They stop one of the canisters of this deadly gas from being released into the underground city. They are your comrades. The second canister was released. The gas does its evil work now. Men, do not enter the underground city, even to save your families, unless you wear gas masks. Women are safe to enter. But there is madness in the underground city!
Men at the barricades now fought swarms of attackers streaming from the tunnel of the underground city entrance.
Paul, what was the diameter of that pipe, do you think?
2 inches, maybe more.
And with the airflow cut off, it'll take longer for that gas to filter through the pipe, won't it? What if we make it through the tunnel and block the pipe before it hits the ventilation system? Or shut off the ventilation system entirely. Let's do it!
They closed on the metallic defense shields. Soldiers at the barricades fought enemies from behind them. Female defenders bore the worst of it. Men from the underground city poured from its bowels, attacking men and women as the women ran into the city to rescue loved ones. Rourke climbed up onto the barricade. Gas-frenzied, knife-wielding men fought, their eyes wide, their lips drawn back like animals baring their teeth. Their bodies were painted in each other's blood. Rourke saw a blur of black against the metallic shields and jumped from the barricade. Paul Rubinstein right beside him. The survivalist team shoved past the dueling men, their weapons tight against their slings, their eyes darting left and right. Another horde of men poured from the underground city, their uniforms tinged with blood, madness in their eyes. A blonde-haired woman in full battle uniform except for her helmet stood her ground until six of the men charged her and she backed away.
Paul! Right!
Rourke angled right. The M16 fell to his side on its sling. He grappled the nearest of the six men to the ground with a simple shoulder grip. Rourke hammered his right fist into the man's jaw. The blow would normally have put a man of average size out unless he were a boxer and his jaw toughened. The man was of average size, but he kept fighting. The man rolled, drawing a pistol from his belt. He raised it to fire as Rourke sidestepped. Rourke drew one of the scoremasters. There was no way to tell right now if the condition of the gas victims was permanent. Rourke's stomach churned, knowing he might have just killed an innocent victim. He wheeled right. Paul Rubinstein was hammering down another of the men with the butt of his Schmeisser, swinging it like a battle hammer.
Help! Help me!
Four other men ringed a blonde-haired girl and were forcing her back against the tunnel wall. She raised her rifle, but in her eyes, Rourke saw she would not shoot until it was too late. Rourke launched himself toward the four men, throwing his body in a body block against the backs of two of the men, throwing the men in turn into their comrades in madness. Rourke rolled to his feet, shaking his head to clear it. Paul Rubinstein picked up an Animoff assault rifle one of the men dropped. He swung it like a baseball bat, the stock splitting as rifle contacted jawbone. The man's head snapping back. Rourke shook his head again, taking two long steps forward. He wheeled on his right foot as his left foot snapped up and out, landing a double kick to the chest of one man. His left foot swung down as his upper body pitched slightly. He snapped his right foot up and out and back into the chest of another of the men. Rourke wheeled forward. He landed a left hook on the jaw of the man he just kicked in the chest. Rourke hammered the man down. Paul was on the fourth man now, the battered Browning high power in his right fist. He slammed it into the crazed man's skull. Rourke raised his assault rifle as he wheeled a full 360 degrees. With his left hand, he felt for the safety. It was up.
Who are you?
John Rourke. Paul here and I, we couldn't prevent Karamazov from using the second canister. But you can help us now. Help your people. The gas is coming from the greenhouse nearest to the barricade through a pipe, maybe 2 inches in diameter. The pipe feeds to the ventilation system for the underground city somehow. If we can block the pipe or close off the ventilation system, we can stop some of the gas. Help us.
Yes. Come with me. Hurry.
They sprang into the tunnel at a run.
Come on, Paul! Right behind you, John!
Rourke threw himself into the run, holding his assault rifle in his right fist by the pistol grip. Paul was at the edge of his peripheral vision, the Schmeisser in an assault position, held high. The blonde-haired woman looked at him.
Hurry!
Yeah!
A few yards ahead, a crowd of madmen attacked one another. Rourke saw that as the madness grew, there was no selectivity. All was lost around the men. They killed each other. Rourke, Paul, and the woman dodged past a knot of the unfortunates. The end of the tunnel was just ahead. A group of women were there, fighting off another group of male attackers. Rourke angled toward them, the blonde woman beside him. Paul Rubinstein turned toward them as well. Rourke threw himself into the knot of attackers, rifle-butting them down.
These two men, they help us. We must reach the main ventilation system controls. If we must fight our way every step of the way, by the time we reach the controls, it will do no good. Help us!
One of the women, then another, and another picked up rifles and knives from the unconscious men around them. One of the women, big in every proportion, heavy glasses on her plain face, looked toward the other women.
Comrades, to battle!
The women formed a running wedge ahead of Rourke, Rubinstein, and the blonde-haired girl. The beefy-looking woman was using an inverted rifle like a club, swatting away attackers as they lunged for her or the others. They ran on, past the upended secondary barricade shields. Fires raged within the cavern just beyond the tunnel. John Rourke and his companions entered hell on earth. Men in the same uniforms attacked each other, beat each other mercilessly, their uniforms already blood-drenched. But this was Karamazov's hell.
Karamazov, motherfucker.
What? Karamazov! I'll get him, so help me God.
They ran on, turning right down a small corridor. Some of the women who had joined them fell back.
It is this way! Hurry!
Comrades! We shall hold them here! Form a line! On me! Hurry!
Rourke glanced back at the woman. The big woman's eyes met with his. Behind the glasses, her pretty eyes smiled.
We'll make it, comrades!
Massive double doors swung open into the sprawling ventilation room. It was as huge as the generator rooms he had seen in power plants. The ceiling, 100 feet high at least, steel catwalks and narrower girders lacing the airspace.
It is down there, 2 levels down.
As they turned toward the ladders leading down, men in technicians' coveralls, pistols in their hands, the look of madness in their eyes growled from the catwalk high above. Rourke and Paul Rubinstein dropped into firing crouches in front of the blonde woman. The men shared a quick glance.
Shoot!
Rourke and the others ran ahead to the ladder, looking for the controls 2 floors below. He could see a massive panel on an island of steel at the hub of a wheel spoked with catwalks from 4 sides.
Is that it?
Yes. I think so.
That is it. The master control is encased in plastic, a big red switch. My man, he works here, and sometimes he said he would pull it himself.
Never mind. Stay there. Hold the catwalk. Be careful.
With feet and hands on the ladder railing, letting himself drop, he skidded down the ladder as though it were a pole, then swung away as he reached the level below. No one was there. He saw Paul following him down. John and Paul slid down the ladder to the next level. They swung onto the larger catwalk that ringed the spokes of the hub where the controls were. He could see the plastic boxed red master control switch, but on the catwalk, between him and the controls, stood a man of extraordinary size. He was a soldier, his helmet gone, his rifle inverted like a club, his eyes wide with the madness. John Rourke stepped out onto the catwalk.
I am here to help you and make you well. Put down your rifle. Just step back. I need to reach the switch.
The man stood his ground. Rourke edged forward slowly, ready to use a gun, not wanting to.
Please.
The big man, 6'6" or better, over 250 pounds, charged, swinging his assault rifle in huge circles over his head. John Rourke eyed the man, eyed the switch. Rourke drew both of the small Detonix pistols from beneath his arms, thumbing back the hammers. Still the man came, madness in his eyes. The massive man rocked and stumbled. Rourke wanted to reach for him as the body fell back. Rourke stepped toward the man, the rifle falling over the catwalk, the huge man's body tumbling after it. Rourke closed his eyes for an instant. Opening them, after a moment, he ran forward, toward the island, upping the safeties of the pistols in his hands. Inverting them, he smashed the butts of the pistols against the plastic protective covering. Rourke stuffed the pistol from his right fist into his belt as he jerked down the switch. Three hours after the gas flow stopped, the men who survived the gassing and ensuing battle simply sat down and fell asleep. Paul Rubinstein and John Rourke vanished from the underground city. The German force was not strong enough to penetrate it and hold it. As he fled, Rourke stopped for a moment to acknowledge the large woman who now lay dead in the corridor. She died fighting to buy Rourke, Rubinstein, and the two other women time in which to shut down the ventilation system. Rourke bent over her, closed her eyes, folded her glasses neatly and cradled them in her lifeless hand.
Thank you.
John and Paul used cameras to photograph the Soviet defenses. Both men felt almost unclean doing it. There was a chance of peace, perhaps, with the survivors of the underground city. The small German force, with the aid of members of Jay's tribe, performed two tasks. They took prisoners from among Karamazov's forces for interrogation, and prisoners from among those affected by the gas in order to study the gas's effects to be able to defend against it. The bulk of Karamazov's force, more than 8,000 men and women, and the majority of the still battle-worthy equipment, moved out to the east. German units followed at a discreet distance to plan the next move in the growing war. Several thousand of the Russians, men and women, laid down their arms, going to aid their families and comrades within the underground city. Those among the thousands in Karamazov's force who broke off from battle made up an estimated 3/5 of the total who laid down their arms. John Rourke considered it a sign that humanity still possessed a basic good. John Rourke, Natalia Tyamarovna, Annie and Paul Rubinstein, Michael Rourke, Otto Hammerschmidt, Captain Hartmann, and Dr. Maria Leuden stood on the wall of rock overlooking the underground city. Vehicles still smoldered from artillery or mortar hits. The ground between the high rock wall and the entrance to the underground city lay pockmarked with shell holes, blackened with fire, littered with dead. John held Natalia's hand. His face was turned into the wind. Although he wore his dark-lensed aviator glasses, he squinted against the bright sun.
Karamazov will need a manufacturing base for resupply. He'll have to avoid battle until he finds it. He'd have fuel and ammunition cached, but that won't last forever. But there's a civilization to the east. He'll find it, use it. We don't have the manpower to engage him now, but we have to go after him.
What will we do?
Try to outthink his next move, Annie. If he headed east, he headed east for a reason. We have to find out what before he gets there.
Jay asked me something before we sent him to the hospital in Argentina.
What did he say, Fräulein Major?
Jay asked, is fighting and killing what it means to be civilized? He wanted an answer. I didn't have any.
John Rourke stared down at the battleground, at the dead there. He didn't have any either. Vladimir Karamazov walked slowly across the snow. In the distance, the helicopter gunships were on guard against attack by forces of the underground city or by the Germans. Natalia routed his forces, disrupted the attack. A jet streaked overhead. rising from the airfield at the staging area to which he had withdrawn. But the jet and the others that followed were not going to be battle, only reconnaissance. There were many options open to him. The Germans could have a sufficiently large force. The defenses of the underground city would be severely depleted. If he took the underground city, he would not have sufficient forces between casualties and defections. 1,800 defected, 391 killed at last count, 200 more, at least, injured. To both defend the city and attack the Germans and the Eden Project and the Hecla community. Vehicles were still coming in, carrying supplies and the less seriously wounded.
Natalia.
His right hand fingered the butt of his pistol beneath the heavy coat he wore against the cold. It was Rourke again, perhaps one of those who disrupted the gas attack. That mattered little now. His forces had transferred the remaining gas into smaller canisters.
There is more than enough gas to turn my adversaries against each other. To kill each other.
Vladimir Karamazov closed his eyes tight, very tight. So tightly that his eyes began to hurt him. He tried to make the picture he wanted come to life in his mind. And he could see it starting to form. John Rourke, eyes wide with madness. The body of Rourke's wife. The body of Rourke's daughter. The body of Rourke's Jewish friend. He could see it, their bodies riddled with bullet wounds, limbs hacked away. Pistol in Rourke's one hand, a bloody knife in the other. Rourke's hands covered with their blood. He could see Michael Rourke, the one who looked so like his father. He could imagine Michael Rourke, the madness gripping him, locked in combat, father against son, their fists hammering each other. John Rourke's hands finding his knife, the knife gouging into his son's face and neck and chest. Finally, the body still and dead beneath John Rourke. Finally, Rourke's hands closing around Natalia's neck, the whiteness of Natalia's skin reddening, purpling, her tongue swelling as it distended, drool mixed with blood oozing from between her lips. Vladimir Karamazov opened his eyes. He stared skyward. Sometimes he wished there were a god.
My hour will come, inevitably. You can't stop me, even if you exist. And he can't stop me. John Rourke cannot stop me. He cannot stop me. John Rourke cannot stop me.
Survivalist The Terror is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1987, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, James Konacek, Tom Simpson, Richard Rowan, Dylan Lynch, Elizabeth Demery, Lily Beacon, Ren Casey, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Hayes Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers and Greg Reinfeld. Adapted for graphic audio by Josh Cristiano. With original music by Matt Webb. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Oh, Well, that's funny. The door's open. Hello? Miss Sally? Sally? Sally, wake up. Please. Please wake up.
Oh, smoke.
Stay right here, Miss Sally. Just hang on, okay?
Lapeer, Moore, and Daggett. Never heard of them. But they're damn sure gonna hear from me.
You take them damn guns off and I'll show you what a real man can do.
I'll take them off anytime you're ready, donkey face.
About right now, cowboy. Outside.
Suits me, lard ass.
All right now. Are you ready to get your...
I just blew the bank building, John.
Goddamn heathen! Come on, you sonny scum!
Now we all find out something I've always known.
What's that, Your Majesty?
Who's the better man, of course?
Hell, Davidson! I've known that since the first time I laid eyes on you. You couldn't shine my boots.
Forward, troops! Advance and wipe out the Mongols!
Let's go, boys.
From Big Rock, Colorado to Keene, New Hampshire and back again. Smoke is blazing a bloody trail of retribution. In Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man 4, Revenge of the Mountain Man. Available now from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.